This is the Education Gadfly Show.
We will go back to the Final Four.
Fighting Quakers?
Yes, we'll go back to the Final Four one day.
They're pacifists.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my special guest for this week, Dr. Paul Morgan, Professor of Education and Demography and Director of the Center for Educational Disparities Research at Pennsylvania State University. Whew, Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here, Mike.
Yeah, and also welcome my co-host, Alyssa Schwenk.
Hey, Mike, and since you didn't start with a pop culture reference, I'm going to take Anna Wintour since this is Metball Week.
Wait. Oh, I don't even know who that is. Who is it?
Oh, my God. The editor of Vogue. It's Metball Week.
Yes, and it's something about the Catholicism.
Good. Very good.
Thank you. See, I pay some attention.
You're on Twitter. Something happens inevitably.
And Paul, so excited to have you here, even though you're at Penn State. And we are big Michigan fans on this podcast.
Right, okay. Penn fans.
But, or Penn as, who's a Penn fan? Go Quakers. Come
yes,
on,
Yes, the
Alyssa.
Fighting Quakers. Come on. We will go back
Wait,
to the Final
the fighting
Four.
Fighting Quakers?
Yes, we'll go back to the Final Four one day.
They're pacifists, Quakers.
Yes, that's the joke. Oh. It's funny.
It's great. All right. Always, that's the Ivy League for you. Always trying to get some irony in there into their athletic program. Well, Paul is here to talk about disparities in special education and how we often get this wrong in our conventional way of thinking about this. So let's talk about that and more on Ed Reform Update. Paul, you and others have been digging into this question about whether certain groups of students are disproportionately identified for special education services. There's a conventional wisdom out there that that is certainly the case, and that especially kids of color, low-income kids, are disproportionately identified, and that this is bad for them. There was even a regulation that was supposed to come out towards the end of the Obama administration. It is now on hold under the Trump administration that gets at this point. But your research and analysis says that this conventional thinking is wrong. So please help us understand.
Sure. I guess it's helpful to think about this in two ways, one of which is reports of disproportionality. So those are looking at relative differences in population shares that are in the general education and special education environment. So, for example, kind of a simple way to think about it is if you look at the general school age population, about 14% of those students are Black. But if you look at the special education population, about 20% of those students are Black. And these kinds of disparities have been cause for concern and led to inferences that the way that students are identified as having disabilities may be biased and discriminatory.
Right. And we often hear, for example, that in the category that I think unfortunately is still called mental retardation, that African-American boys in particular were forever much more likely to be placed into that category and that represented some, you know, a low expectations for those children.
Right. So there, you can look at it generally within special education, but also within specific disability categories. And for some categories, there's initial evidence of over-identification or over-representation. And for other categories, there's some initial evidence of under-identification. But although this is cause for concern and has been reported on for some time, others have countered that, well, these disparities may be evident, but we're not really sure why they might be occurring. And one hypothesis has been that the disparities are resulting from misidentification based on race or ethnicity. Others have countered that, you know, unfortunately, there's lots of reasons to suspect that the disability prevalence rates may differ between minority and white children in the U.S. So, you know, about 40% of children who are Black are born into poverty versus about 10% of children who are white. Children who are Black are about twice as likely to be exposed to lead or born prematurely, for example. And so because of this unfortunate but greater risk factor exposure, it may be that that's resulting in the observed disparities. And so that debate has been occurring for some time in the special education field and more broadly within education research. And there's been, as you noted, some attending legislation and policy in regards to this issue. What we've tried to do is we've tried to better approximate contrast between otherwise similar children who, for example, seem observationally the same in terms of their clinical need for services.
How are you guys identifying whether or not the students are similar?
So we are analyzing nationally representative and longitudinal data sets, as well as cross-sectional data sets most recently. And notable feature of these data is that rather than only allow for control of, say, district-level aggregate controls, we're able to control for student level or family level potential confounds. So the leading alternative explanation for the observed disparities is because of the greater risk factor exposure of minority students, they oftentimes arrive at schools with experiencing academic difficulties because of a greater incidence of cognitive or other types of impairments. And that explains the observed disparity. So it's a difference in clinical need rather than biased or discriminatory identification practices. So we're trying to compare children who display the same levels of academic achievement, particularly very low levels of achievement, and then amongst those children who are otherwise similarly achieving, who is more or less likely to be identified as having disabilities. And so when we approximate these otherwise similar contrasts between children, we consistently find again and again that minority children are less likely to be identified as having disabilities than otherwise similar white or English-speaking children.
And the way you put that is important because you say less likely or more likely to be receiving the services. I mean, a lot of people in this field think of being labeled as needing special education as a mark against the kids or a lowering of expectations. Mm-hmm. As you have argued, it means that they are going to be eligible for additional services. And so if anything, children of color are being discriminated against and that they are not getting access to services that similar white kids are getting and therefore missing out on some of these opportunities. And yet again, the narrative is exactly the opposite. It's that that we're over-identifying kids of color. I'm curious, Paul, as you've tried to explain this to people, especially in the special education community, which my understanding is still very much forcefully advocating for the Obama-era regulation and for making districts do something if they have disparities in this opposite direction, the sort of disparities based just on the descriptive data. Mm-hmm. Have you had any success in changing people's minds about this?
That's a good question. We've been talking to a number of researchers, and I think that there is openness to the empirical findings. And I think it's been well known in the field that the methodological limitations of the prior reporting have been reported on by others. So, for example, there's a National Research Council report from 2002 investigating disproportionality in special education and concluding very explicitly, we don't really know why these disparities are occurring. It may be because of differences in clinical need. We really need to take that into account, including in analyses of nationally representative data.
Right.
And so we've been trying to do that.
But in terms of the advocates, I guess, not any progress yet.
I think that there's a feeling based on simple descriptive statistics as well as anecdotal reporting that there's bias in the system in the way that children are being identified.
And there could be,
and that's certainly an important consideration. And when it's occurring, it should be stopped. We want a situation where we want children with disabilities to receive additional services to which they have a civil right, regardless of their race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And we also want a situation where students are being placed into special education based on their race and ethnicity. But if we look across the entirety of the U.S., what seems to be both widespread and longstanding is that relative to white and English-speaking children, minority children are less likely to be identified as having disabilities, despite displaying the same clinical need for those services.
I mean, I also think, and this is coming from, you know, less clinical, more personal place, having been a former teacher, and now my sister is a special education teacher at a Title I high school. There's such a big difference between identification and actually meeting the needs of the students. And as you said, this is a civil right that goes well back to the 70s with the introduction of a free and appropriate public education. And the question, I think it's an important question that we're answering, but I also think the question needs to be asked as to whether or not once kids are being identified, that they're given the services that they need, not because they're an opportunity, but because they are those students' rights. Mm-hmm. And particularly when we've got high concentrations of students of color in the same schools, that becomes, you know, an intervening factor in whether or not we're able to provide the same level of services that we're able to provide to those students who, like my family had, across all branches, a lot of students who were in special education, but we also had a lot of affluent parents who were able to lobby and advocate the school district to get that free and appropriate public education.
I think that's an important point. We've been looking at you know, who gets in the door, so to speak, in terms of receiving services, and less at what happens after they enter. And they're both important questions. We want equity in the identification process. We want equity in terms of the service delivery that we're providing. These services are expensive to provide, and we've heard many anecdotal reports that schools are reluctant to provide them, and that families often need to pursue legal action to secure them. And, you know, that's difficult to do unless you're a family of means.
That's right.
For example.
That's right. And it's striking, Paul, you know, how similar this debate is to the school discipline debate that we've been having, been a part of here at Fordham and on this show.
Right.
You know, that when you look at the raw data, the discipline disparities are quite shocking. And many people have jumped to the conclusion that that represents racial bias. And as I've always said, almost surely that racial bias is a part of it, but it's probably not all of it. And as you say, when you have these risk factors like poverty and lead poisoning and other issues that vary by race, tragically vary by race, then you are likely to see this show up in student behavior as well. And that's the factor that we can't look at. We don't have a good way of knowing the actual behavior. And so all we have are the raw data. But if we can start to control for more of these other things, what we might find is that those disparities are at least smaller than they appear. And then we get a better sense of where the racial bias may be coming in.
Right. And we've acknowledged again and again that, you know, historical and ongoing segregation, bias may be contributing to the risk factor exposure, and other mechanisms that might result in disability. Yeah. And there may be discrimination that's occurring in schools, and that's important to investigate. At the same time, when you have a child who can't read, and it's not because of economic disadvantage, and you've ruled out a language background as an alternative factor, and you've seen the child has pronounced academic difficulties that are continuing, at some point, I think it's reasonable to consider that the child may have a reading disability or other type of disability. And if we're not providing services to children that have these conditions, all we're doing is making it more likely that the child struggles academically. And that in and of itself can lead to the type of school to prison pipeline that sometimes, you know, or people have often talked about. In fact, there seems to be a good deal of reporting that in the juvenile justice and adult populations, there's quite a bit of undiagnosed, unrecognized disability. Yep. And one wonders if those children had appropriately received services previously, whether we could have improved their life opportunities.
That's a huge, hugely important question. Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Paul Morgan, Director of the Center for Educational Disparities Research at Penn State University. Super important issue, and especially as we watch this federal regulation debate at the federal level. Dr. Morgan, thanks for coming on. Hope you'll come on again sometime soon. All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
We have already had a big dose of research, so we're going to keep it going.
All right. Okay. Nobody's tiring out. Hopefully, research is good stuff.
Us
we
never.
Like it.
All right. We got a new study out by Calder. Yes, I like Calder. Researchers Ben Backus and James Cowan this time. They examine whether taking a standardized test online versus on paper impacts how the students perform. We've been hearing a lot about this, right? With latest NAEP results, it kind of came up recently. So there's a lot of discussion around whether there are quote unquote mode effects, and we don't have a lot of good studies on it. So analysts use data from Massachusetts to examine whether students who take the test online score systematically lower than if they had taken the test on paper. And then second, they look if there are any differences across subgroups. Okay. And just a little background first. Massachusetts in 2015 and 2016 administered the PARC test, both on paper and online. Remember this, right? Specifically in 2015, districts could choose between MCAS and the new PARC test. And the state agreed to a hold harmless provision for all schools administering the PARC in either year, whether online or on paper. And then ultimately, 72% of elementary and middle schools administered the new test in either of those years. And of those administering it, 57% administered it online at least once. So it set up this nice sort of experiment that you could look at and compare these groups. The Calder study ultimately includes schools that administered PARC in both years, which results in about half of the students enrolled in grades 3 through 8. Between 2011 and 2016, they look at the earlier data to control for prior achievement. Mm-hmm. And 88% of students in schools administering PARC in 2015 and 2016. So it's a pretty nice sample. Mm-hmm. They use two analytic approaches for folks who care about that. They use a difference in difference design that compares the differential impact of the mode on both the treatment and the control group. Mm-hmm. And they also use OLS. And then the MCAS paper assessment or the test scores that are used as a control. Okay. All right. Enough of that. They find mode effects of about 0.10 standard deviations in math and 0.25 standard deviations in ELA. Mm. And these effects equate to about 5.4 months of learning in math and 11 months of learning in ELA in a 9-month school year. So that's
a lot.
They find similar effects across both models. Just told you they did two models. And then they perform a number of robustness checks, as all these papers do, to say, okay, are what we're seeing, is it for real? And they're looking at whether the pre-existing trends in school performance are driving their results. They're able to determine that's not what's going on here. And then they look to see if there are mode effects in the next year, right? So maybe this was just a one-time phenomenon, a one-time blip. And they still find them, however, for second-time test takers. Mm-hmm. But this time, they're about one-third as large as the first year in math, and they're about half as large in ELA. So then they do a bunch of tests, and they're able to determine that student familiarity with the test is what's driving that reduced mode effect in year two. And then finally, relative to subgroups, they find little variation by subgroups except one that really sort of stuck out. And that was mode effects for ELA test for students who are at the bottom of the achievement distribution. Mm-hmm. So finally, they recommend at the end that, you know what, if you're going to switch right, from paper to online and you're going to use these for accountability purposes, you need to take test mode effects into account. Yep. And a little footnote in the paper, which I wasn't aware, apparently starting in 2017, Massachusetts had started to use some statistical adjustments to correct mode effects, at least during the transition from paper to online.
Very good. Now, look, I think that is quite common. I mean, I think that people know that this mode effect has been found in other places, other times.
Small scale. There's been some small scale.
And so, you know, they try to adjust for it. And on the NAEP, they did adjust for it nationally. Mm-hmm. And but the question was at the state level and then at the local, the TUDA district level, whether they had a big enough sample in order to make the adjustments. The answer was no. So basically, you know, there are some states out there who have arguing, hey, we are being unfairly punished. Louisiana, one of them, where the you know, they don't test the kid, the young kids online in Louisiana. So this, you know, then they took the NAEP. Big they shot. Were really unfamiliar and maybe had a mode effect that was particularly large. As you say, it, it drops if you start doing more online testing. It's probably not just that the kids have seen it once before. It's that probably in their classrooms, they start doing a lot more. On the computers, like, hey, we're going to practice writing an essay on the computer.
But I don't know how recent this is. I mean, if you'll recall, I mean, we were doing the big assessment study in Massachusetts when all this was going on. Mm-hmm. And I remember the higher ups in Massachusetts saying, you know, it's not really making a big difference, you know, in terms of the mode and we're not seeing it and yada, yada. And then when this came out, they were more aware of it. I mean, Jeff Nellhaus is on the record. Saying,
Yeah,
we don't really see too much of a difference here. Yeah. We're doing our own internal, you know, yada, yada. So, yeah, I mean, I think it takes studies like this to kind of get people to, you know, really pay attention.
Yeah, and just to like kind of pull up from the forest, the trees to the forest.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, and, you know, and again, the Louisiana scores are where you just saw, I mean, their kids just tanked on the NAEP. Yeah, and, and it just doesn't seem to make sense given all of the great work going on down there. It's not what happened on their own assessment. It makes you wonder whether this was a big factor. And and if so, you know, by the time they take the NAEP the next time around, you know, maybe they'll be more ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, I love what I loved about this paper is in the appendix, they showed you three or four items, the same item on paper and the computer. And you could see on the computer, like there's all these buttons for kids to scroll down and highlight and do this. And it's like, wow, that may be conceptually the same item, but like the skills that are required to like manipulate and figure out to get the answer is totally different.
No, and of course, ELA, because they have to write using a keyboard.
That's
and
right.
And believe me, with
one little finger, right?
It's time to, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, so they're being assessed on, you know, what can they write, but also, you know, their keyboarding.
And are they going to get frustrated, right?
With I mean, I do think this transition makes sense. You know, this is what the kids are going to be doing going on. But, you know, there's some debate about whether really like third grade, is that too early? You know, should we be still paper and pencil testing, at least in the earlier grades.
Right. And how long does it take, right, before you don't have to do these adjustments anymore, where you can have confidence that kids are, you know, that you're actually measuring their content and not their computer fluency. So.
All right. Good stuff,
Amber.
I like it.
Research-packed education gadfly.
Absolutely. Love it. All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.